Hello and welcome to Eggpod Express with me, Chris Shaw. Eggpod Express takes a jaunty stroll through 1960s music magazines with a potpourri of delicious guests. To read along with us, the magazine's online at iamtheeggpod.com. We'll also find an exclusive playlist of this week's top 30 singles. To support this podcast and to access any bonus content, please subscribe to patreon.com/eggpod. In this episode, I'm joined by author, journalist, broadcaster, Pete Perfides. Hello.
Hello, Chris. How are you doing?
I'm fine. Long time no.
I feel like it's a major triumph for me that I persuaded you to come to my kitchen. And also, I feel delighted that for the first time, because as we discussed earlier on, you're the first person I've met outside of my immediate family who prefers instant coffee to the other kinds of coffee, which means that I can finally crack out the red branded matching Nescafe mug, coffee pot and milk jug from which you can decant your coffee at any time you see fit.
And sponsorships are available if anyone's listening.
That would be nice, wouldn't it?
It would be nice, yeah. You've, the new Wings book and the new Wings album you've been involved in, I see.
Yeah, this is stuff I was doing about a year ago now. I think in the world of Wings and MPL and Paul McCartney, things sort of take a long time to gestate. So about a year and a half ago, I was asked to, if I would be interested, there's a sort of new oral history of Wings, an official oral history of Wings out as a hardback book with new interviews with Paul, which are augmented with new and existing interviews with people who were all kind of involved with Wings in some way. And so in the event of anyone picking up the book who wants to know this story, but, you know, sees the words Band on the Run in front of them, but doesn't actually know what Band on the Run is, then there's a section at the back where I explain what Band on the Run is, how it happened, why it matters, what's great about it, and then further down, and then you might see, you know, the name Denny Lane in there. And improbable as it is, given that you're reading this book, you might want to go, Denny Lane, I've heard of him. I need more information on this Denny Lane chap. And, you know, just in case you think it's a typo of Penny Lane. And then and then you can go and read. So I did all those bits. And I think they must have liked them, because then I was asked to write a foreword for the concurrently released, simultaneously released three-disc compilation. And, you know, after I just stopped shuddering and pinching myself, then I got on with it. And that was a really nice thing to do, because it allowed me to sort of decant some thoughts that I've had about, you know, Paul and what a kind of low-key, radical kind of character he was in the 70s, some of which we discussed in our egg pod that we did together, yes. Band on the Run. And so it's really nice to do that. And, you know, yeah, made up, as you can imagine.
Wonderful.
So, we're going back to the week ending 15th of April 1967. This was the week that saw Sandy Shaw winning the Eurovision Song Contest, first Boeing 737 make its maiden flight, and Elizabeth Taylor and Paul Scofield winning Best Actor and Actress at the Academy Awards for A Man for All Seasons. So we're not quite yet basking in the summer of love, but we are gambling through the spring of like. Sorry. And in this episode, we're talking about Record Mirror. And Pete, you were saying you've got quite the collection.
Well, I pick them up where I can, because they're just such a great read. And I'm a huge believer in the fact that, you know, contemporaneous sources are the best sources because of all the incidental detail you pick up along the way. It could be an advert for a new release. It could be a piece of gossip. And, you know, it's an unfolding story from week to week. So you're getting reactions to things that were, you know, in a previous issue, things that are given more column inches than we might sort of expect. And, you know, the big stories of the late 60s aren't always the big stories that we remember. And so I think it's really important to sort of go back and you know, once you've seen what a big deal at that point in time Dave D, Dozy, Beaky, Mick and Titch were, then we need to understand Dave D, Dozy, Beaky, Mick and Titch. And we need to, you know, we need to sort of get our heads around why they were kind of a constant presence in the charts.
Yes.
And I'm a bit of a fan, actually, of them, you know, yeah. of their music. I think they're sort of unfairly forgotten, but I can see why. Or, you know, this unfolding sagas that, you know, Scott Walker's clamour to be taken seriously and, you know, the relentless cavalcade of slightly pretentious, earnest interviews he gives, in which he just does not seem to be a very happy man. He sort of seems to be, feels like he's backed himself into a corner. And that kind of tells you, that gives you an indication of what his late 60s are going to be like. In a way, it kind of seeds the entire narrative of his career way beyond the 60s into, you know, right up until his death, really. Yeah. So yeah, loads of stuff. You know, so much stuff. I my happy place is looking through these magazines.
And me. So Record Mirror, a few key facts. It was founded in 1954 by Isadora Green, who was former editor of Weekly Sporting Review, and as well as publishing the UK singles chart in 56, they published the first UK album chart, and in 1959 it was briefly suspended due to a national printing site, later renamed Record and Show Mirror. And in 61, Decca replaced founder Green with Jimmy Watson. Circulation rose to 70,000, and they published the first national articles on the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, the Who and the Kinks. And in 63, they reverted back to Record Mirror, and it was the first music paper to use full colour printing. So the one we're talking about is the week ending 15th of April, and we've got a big picture of, well, it's what we got.
It's Manfred Mann, isn't it? And they're dressed as clowns. Because their single is called Ha Ha Said the Clown. It's sitting in the top 10 at the time of publication. I don't think this was their idea, because they're really not very happy clowns. They look like they just basically turned up to the photo shoot and they're doing this under duress. So,
yeah.
I mean, one of them's dressed as a jester. They're dressed as different kinds of clowns and people in clowning professions. Yeah, he's wearing a sort of pointy hat, and then there's two of them. One of them is dressed as a sort of some kind of harlequin type thing. Yeah, they're not happy. And, you know, it's amazing that not what was it, 3 years later, they put out Manfred Mann 3, which was, you know, this amazing album that's kind of sits at the intersection of like pop rock and British jazz.
Yeah.
Really kind of. I need someone, possibly Manfred himself, to sit down and explain to me what their journey, what their narrative. And, you know, and then beyond that, Manfred Mann's Earth Band, they were featured on my first ever various artists compilation that I bought, Hot Tracks, with Don't Kill It, Carol. Yeah, like a really fascinating band. I need someone to really give me a deep dive explanation of Manfred Mann and all the decisions they made.
Yeah.
Throughout
I think later on in this issue, he talks about wanting to get into films, which obviously they would do next year. They did the soundtrack album.
Hmm.
But I guess there's a theatrical bent here. I think it's more a case of, right, here's your new single, here's your clothes. I mean, Mike Darbo's trousers look about 10 times too big. I think he's...
They do, don't holding, they?
I'm assuming that's what he's doing.
Yeah, I feel for them. This is pre-Mighty Quinn, isn't it? Mighty Quinn hadn't become Quinn.
No, that was 68, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So they've got it all ahead of them, really.
And the album they did the following year, which is awesome, Mighty Garvin.
That's got a brilliant... That's my favourite Manfred Mann song is on that, Each and Every Day.
Yes.
Daytime, nighttime, anything I say, any time of day, and she's mine. There's no doubt about, she can't do without.
Each and Every Day is one of those songs. It's a little bit like one of those songs like Graham Gouldman's It's Nice to Be Out in the Morning, which is, it's so amazing to hear a song. And I'm mentioning these songs deliberately so that people can go off and listen to them and have their lives hopefully enriched by them, as mine has been. Because these songs are really, you know, Penny Lane's one of those songs as well, that they absolutely kind of distill this sort of platonic ideal of 60s positivity at the kind of cusp of psychedelia, but not really participating in psychedelia. And they just make you feel like it's really these are songs we need to listen to right now, yes. You know, where we are in the world right now, because they're sort of the very opposite feeling of everything that's kind of permeating right now. A sort of benign, low-key, cosmic positivity that extends to your sort of attitude to your neighbour. Mighty Go, I don't really understand why this. I mean, I'm looking at, it's only had 24,000 streams on Spotify. Each and Every Day by Manfred Mann is one of those songs.
Yeah.
I love it so much. It will turn a sad mood into a happy mood.
It's So Easy Falling is just beyond words, is my probably one of my favourite Manfred songs.
I'm going to dig this out. We'll listen to it after we've attended to our business.
In fact, that's the show over. Let's do it. And at the bottom of the front page, we have an advert. It's the latest single from Davy Jones, although it's not strictly, is it really?
No, it came out in 1965, so it's but it's a cash in, right? It's a cash in,
yeah.
Because he's a monkey now, and it's a version of It Ain't Me, Babe.
Go away from my window, leave at your own chosen speed. I'm not the one you want, babe. I'm not the one you need. You say protect you and defend you, whether you are right or wrong. Go on to open each and every door. It ain't me, babe. I said it, no, no, no. It ain't me, babe. It ain't me you're looking for.
Do you know what else is on the same album?
Yeah, you've also got things like Any Old Iron. Maybe It's Because I'm a Londoner.
Yeah, so it's really leaning into all the things that, you know, I guess Americans are sort of supposed to love about him.
Yeah, it's that Herman's Hermit's cheeky chappy.
Yeah, kind of, yeah. So, but it ain't me. But I don't really mind the sort of arrangement. His voice is a bit of a struggle at times, isn't it? I can stomach it on things like Little Bit Me, Little Bit You. Maybe less so on. It's on the Colpix label. That's a funny label.
Cold Gems was the Monkees, wasn't it? That was formed for them, so it must be a subsidiary. Yeah.
Anti-war demonstrators protest U.S. involvement in the Vietnam War in mass marches, rallies, and demonstrations. Central Park is the starting point for the parade to the U.N. building. The estimated 125,000 Manhattan marchers include students, housewives, beatnik poets, doctors, businessmen, teachers, priests, and nuns. Makeup and costumes were bizarre. Before the parade, mass draft card burning was urged. Demonstrators claimed 200 cards were burned, but no accurate count could be determined. Reporters and onlookers were jostled away on purpose. Although mostly peaceful, shouted confrontations were frequent and fiery during the course of the march. The anti-war marchers were picketed by anti-anti-war marchers who were hawkish toward the parading doves. Civil rights leader Martin Luther King leads the procession to the United Nations, where he urges UN pressure to force the US to stop bombing North Vietnam. Police arrested five persons as disorderly. Three were grabbed when they rushed the parade float. No serious injuries, however, in New York's biggest anti-war march.
Music, that's our middle name. Music.
So it turns page two. And it's your page. Want to let off steam?
It's literally my page because I own this magazine. So the crinkling that you can hear isn't a sound effect. It's actually my copy of this particular issue of Record Mirror.
Yeah.
Yeah, Want to Let Off Steam. And so, yeah, James Craig is the letters editor. My attention was turned to Stephen Robinson of Worcester Park in Surrey, and he's written to complain about what he sees as the debilitating effect that the miming ban has had on TV music shows. And he's referring to the new regulation instituted the previous August, which stated that any musicians performing their music on TV had to be doing a lot more than moving their lips. Top of the Pops, he writes, used to feature artists on film miming to records if they could not come to the studio. And now we see them playing ping pong or walking around the park if the record is playing. That's just not on, according to Stephen Robinson.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this is a kind of argument about authenticity, isn't it? And about how, you know, why on earth would anyone want to mime to a record? It's almost, yeah, it's sort of cheapening. You know, I guess it just adds to the kind of charade that is pop music.
Yeah, and I think he's also mentions about the fact it's going to benefit sort of people like Engelbert Humperdinck and Tom Jones, who are professional singers, and they'll have proper session musicians behind them, than it will, say, the Troggs, for example. But I think for the benefit, because of this, a lot of bands didn't really want to do this, and so they sent in promotional films. Yeah. So it's around this time throughout 67, you get these, and they're basically pieces of art. You wouldn't, like the video for Strawberry Fields and Penny Lane, Small Faces, Ichiku Park. Arnold Lane by Pink Floyd with a mannequin. And that's an offshoot of this, you know, these middle management musician union.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I guess, you know, this is kind of vital to the kind of eventual invention of the pop video.
Yes.
I never understood, you know, when I was growing up, people used to say things like, oh, well, and then Queen came along with Bohemian Rhapsody, and that's generally regarded as the first ever music video. I was like, well, it's not. It's manifestly not. Is that what did we? It's a little bit like people saying, you know, talking about football and saying, well, this is the kind of the best goal difference in the history of the Premiership. Yeah. Like nothing existed. Mm. Like there was no top flight before 1993. Just drives me bananas. So yeah, no, like, I mean, what was the first music? I mean, I guess Rain, like maybe Rain.
Yeah,
that's, and but even then you got sort of, I guess, what do we think the Stephen Robinson, who wrote this letter, would think about what's the clip where the Beatles made where Ringo isn't even pretending to drum, he's on an exercise bike.
Yeah. Well, they're specially filmed promos, aren't they?
Yeah.
I guess Rain was the first 35mm video.
Yeah.
But there's tons of them. I mean, I'm thinking, have you seen Cobwebs and Strange by The Who?
No.
Keith Moon in a cardboard box, rolling up towards him and then emerging as a robot. No. And that's brilliant. It's perfect. No.
And you're right, there's some really weird ones, like ones that kind of trigger a sort of cognitive dissonance in you. There's the Flirtations doing Nothing But a Heartache in the ruins of Tintern Abbey.
Wow.
And, you know, you just don't expect to see, like, a three-piece American soul band just miming to an absolute barnstorming soul track.
No.
At Tintern Abbey. So, yeah, I guess that's just what was going on. I'm gonna get me a gun. I'm gonna get me a gun.
There's one letter that I did find quite amusing. It's from Mrs. Delia Savin from Islington. She's furious that Cat Stevens has described his latest single as I'm Gonna Get Me a Gun as a cowboy song. I suggest he listens to some genuine cowboy songs before he makes such a stupid remark. She bleats. Anyone who is a true believer in American country music would be even more annoyed by this statement than I am, and I'm only a beginner in collecting their records. I suggest that I wish he put Mr. Cat listens to Johnny Cash, Ray Acuff, Don Gibson, Marty Robbins, Tex Ritter and George Jones. Then he'd really know what a cowboy song sounds like.
Wait till she hears Adam and the Ants.
Yeah.
She'll explode.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great letter. I love these like snapshots, you know, the letters on the letters page are always great because they're real moments in time. There's Bengt Bengtsson from Karlshamn in Sweden. It sounds desperate. He says, I'll pay anything for the hippies' memory lane on Cameo Parkway. And, you know, I remember reading, when I first picked up this magazine, I was so moved by his desperation that at the time, no one had even uploaded this song onto any, on YouTube. It wasn't on Spotify. So I actually found one. I just sent off to one. I said, if it means so much to Bengt Bengtsson, then I need to have it in my collection as well. And it is pretty good. It's great. I can lend it to you, Chris, afterwards, if you like. He says, I'll even send a tape to someone to tape it for me. And this is, like, amazing. Obviously, there's people of my kids' generation, and I'm not saying that our kids today or anything like that. It's fine. I wouldn't want it to be different to how it is now. But nevertheless, they'll never experience that kind of anguish. But it's kind of so abstract to someone growing up now to sort of think that you would kind of commence this very convoluted arrangement where you kind of write a letter in the hope that it will get published somewhere, and then someone will reply, and you'll send them a tape, and then they'll send you a tape back.
Yes.
And it's all because of one song. You know, it's incredible. What I like to do, Chris, is, you know, it's kind of an, I'm not sure if it counts as a hobby, but what I like to do is look at these letters and then try and Google the names of the people who wrote to them, because I want to know what happened next. So Alwyn Brentnell and Loscow Road in Derbyshire writes, anyone want pics of pop stars of 1962 to 63? Most of them are included. Cliff, Elvis, Frank Ifield, Fury, etc. Please send SAE. So he's got a bit of a side hustle here. Mm-hmm. Or maybe not even a side hustle. Maybe a main hustle where he just collects pictures. I mean, I don't know where he gets these pictures from. Is he cutting them out of magazines? I don't know. But it all points to a world where there was just less stuff.
Yes.
And so sometimes you just had to go to these lengths. And anyway, I was sort of thinking, what happened to Alwyn Brentnell of Loscow Road in Derbyshire? So I Googled him. And sadly, he died suddenly at his home on the 18th of January 2015, aged 63 years. Uh-huh. I mean, it's got to be him, right? Because he's in Derbyshire. Mm-hmm. The funeral service is in Derbyshire. And I think he went on to be a policeman because he'll be sadly missed by his daughter and his many friends and colleagues at Ripley Police Headquarters. So, and I just sort of love that. I just love the fact that you just get this glimmer of the subsequent life. Yeah. And so that's what I do in my spare time. I Google people who write letters to Record Mirror.
Yeah. See, I'm thinking there's a good ghost story where you did send an SAE and it came back with a load of photos of Cliff, Elvis, Frank Ifield. There's a ghost story in there somewhere.
I think so, yeah.
Don't say you love me. Don't say you care. You're so far away. Telephone communication, only a 3-minute elation when I hear your voice. Through love and trust, it's gonna work out fine. The only pain I feel is all this time between you and me.
Also on the same page, you've got an article by Bill Harry talking of cowboy songs.
Oh, yeah.
And he's talking about country and western music hits Britain. And obviously after Merseybeat essentially became Music Echo, then Disco Music Echo. So Bill Harry was the original editor. He was gradually eased out.
Yeah.
So here he is writing for a rival publication. And it's based on a drive by an organisation called the Country Music Federation in Denmark Street, London. And they've basically been working behind the scenes in preparations for this year's drive to push country and western music. I mean, there's definitely something in the air.
Mm.
Obviously, the Birds. Arguably, the Monkey, you know, Mike Nesmith was a great exponent for country music.
Some of my favourite Monkey songs are sort of tending in that direction. What Am I Doing Hanging Round? I think that might actually be my favourite Monkey song.
Yeah.
So, absolutely. Yeah, it's really, yeah, it's, you're right, there's something in the air. And, oh, I missed a letter.
Oh, yeah.
I love this. It's from Richard A. Smith. So, sadly, not a Googleable name, but he's in Harwich in Essex. Something missing from the 20 these days. Guitar instrumentals. There are some great releases out now. Maroc 7, Bombay Duck by The Shadows. Double A-side that. Monsoon, Duane Eddy. And Theme from The Wild Angels by The Ventures. Come on, instrumental lovers. Let's make them big hits, especially The Shads, who finished a smash pantomime season in Cinderella, for which they wrote all the words and music. And thanks, RM, for so consistently praising the talents of Hank, Bruce, Brian and John. I mean, that's a real snapshot of changing times, isn't it? Because, yes. You know, instrumental bands are sort of on the back foot. And, you know, and that's, I guess, part that's in no small part thanks to the Beatles, who it kind of blew all that stuff out of the water. Is that fair?
I'm just thinking who ended the year doing Flying, which wasn't instrumental. So maybe they read.
Oh, yeah. Maybe they felt guilty.
Thomas Moy, you have been found guilty of high treason. The sentence of the court...
My lords, when I was practising law, the manner was to ask the prisoner before pronouncing sentence if he had anything to say.
Have you anything to say?
Yes.
Honoured by 6 Academy Awards. A Man for All Seasons.
Sorry, there's just one more thing. An advert on the bottom left for Granny Takes a Trip by the Purple Gang. And these are a band from Stockport. And they were one of these, they were taken under the wing of Joe Boyd. Apparently the name is based on Pink Floyd. Purple Gang, Pink Floyd.
Oh, right, okay.
And there's a great little documentary. I think you can see it on YouTube. But the song was essentially their big song. It was going to be their big song. And it's a great... great song. It's sort of like a cross between the Incredible String Band and Skiffle. It's fantastic. They've got a washboard.
But Granny Takes... God, blimey.
Problem was, despite the fact that they said it was about an old lady going on a day trip, the BBC banned it, and effectively their whole career was screwed. And then oddly, 50 years later, one of the band members... reformed the band, but with like new members, and they had a massive number one in Hungary.
Wow,
huge in Hungary.
That's amazing.
So yeah, it's a great song. In fact, I'm going to just you got to hear it.
Have
a quick look. Sure. It's just, and it's kind of psychedelic skiffle. That's the best way I can describe it.
I see it's on the Transatlantic label, which it's not. It's on their offshoot, Big T.
Oh. It's effectively that all the way through, but it's
brilliant.
And there's a harmonica in there as well. Yeah. This would have definitely been a hit if it hadn't been banned.
That's brilliant.
I
guess. Yeah,
that's it.
So Big T, I'm just thinking, I was asking myself, is this the most psychedelic thing that ever came out on Transatlantic? And I think there's one song which surpasses it, which is bizarrely by the Ian Campbell folk group. And it's this completely, utterly out of character song by them called Dr. Junk, which was on, and you know, again, it's this improbable sort of, so I think they're trying to do a Pink Floyd thing. It sounds very Sid Barrett. And it's just so weird that of all the people that are trying to do it, it's the Ian Campbell folk group. So definitely worth seeking that out as well.
In the event of something happening to me, there is something I would like you all to see. It's just a photograph of someone that I knew. Have you seen my wife, Mr. Jones? Do you know what it's like on the outside? Don't go talking too loud, you'll cause a landslide. Mr. Jones.
And over to page 3, and it's a full page ad for the Bee Gees, New York mining disaster 1941. And they're an exclusive representation, NEMS Enterprise. Because their manager, Robert Stigwith, was a NEMS employee.
It's quite a dramatic looking advert, isn't it? It's a sort of full page photograph of... Is it a negative? No, it's not a negative, is it? But it's kind of it's got this kind of explosion. It looks like an explosion in a mine shaft, not all in a kind of quarry.
It's foreshadowing Led Zeppelin 1.
It is a bit, yeah, yeah. And they bills them as the most significant new musical talent of 1967. And at the time, yeah, I remember looking at this and sort of thinking, I didn't really know where New York mining disaster had got to in the charts. I don't know if you did, Chris. Maybe you looked it up.
I didn't. I thought it was a top 10 hit, wasn't it?
Not quite. It was got to number 12. I thought it was a big hit. And so it's interesting at this point to sort of see that the Bee Gees really have not really planted, you know, significantly sort of planted their flag in the kind of in the zeitgeist at this in the kind of contemporary sort of pop territory.
No.
At this point, I think, you know, the jury's slightly out on how important they'll be, and that's going to continue because 3 months later they put out To Love Somebody, and this is, I didn't know this, and it's completely amazing to me. Didn't even get in the top 40. It got to number 41. To Love Somebody.
What?
To Love Somebody only got to number 41.
Really?
I know.
It's unbelievable.
It was only, and yeah, after that, there was Massachusetts, and then they crashed the top 10 and went all the way to number one. But
I suppose the charts were so strong at that time. That's incredible. Yeah,
it really is. You know, I mean, to love somebody, generally, I think you'd struggle to find someone who didn't think that was one of the sort of greatest singles of that or any era.
Yeah. The following year, another NEMS link. They did a song as a tribute for Brian Epstein called In the Summer of His Years.
In the summer of his years, he would always smile, he would laugh every day. If he was here to stay.
They were churning them out, weren't they, the Bee Gees? I mean, they really were. There was almost like a manic quality to their productivity, wasn't it? And especially Robin, you know.
Yeah.
Who would continue that, you know, after his sabbatical from the Bee Gees.
Yes.
With those two incredible solo albums that he made.
That was years ago. Now my mate had a fake website. We pretended to be two German brothers who were huge Bee Gees fans. One was a huge Robin fan, one was a huge Morris fan.
Hmm.
But they both hated Barry. for whatever reason, but they would argue, your one's bolder than my one. Yes, but your one wears a wig and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And eventually it got picked up by a load of some Robin Gibb forum. Well, and they would, you'd follow the link and go, oh, they're off again, they're off to. But there was one where we took it a bit further because Robin's Rain was his solo album.
That's right,
it?
Yeah.
But we put a thing up, a fake advert selling a bootleg of those sessions called Robin's Brain. And they're going, oh, where can you get this album? Where can you get this album? But
that is,
I digress.
Robin's Brain. How did you spell it? Did you spell it B-R-E-I-G-N?
Turn to page 4 and there's a very large advert.
For James Last. I mean, this is... James Last was, you know, certainly 10 years later on TV adverts for his new... whatever his latest new release was. He was very ubiquitous and he was very sort of synonymous with, like, the music our mums and dads liked, right? But it all just starts here, really. It's his... is it his debut album? They're maybe in this country because they say they've got Polydor... the advert says, introducing the most exciting new sound, James Last. This is James Last. So it looks like a debut. Mm. Instrumentals forever. Hammond a go-go, classics up to date. Beating sweet trumpet a go-go. Oh, are these different releases? These are different.
I think he released a few at the same time.
These are songs that are from these releases. I see. So this is a kind of a launch, really, for him in this country.
I think later on it says, yeah, he's released two albums at the same time.
Okay.
Which I think he did Forevermore, didn't he? I mean, that's not many for him.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Der große Augenblick ist gekommen. Es wird nun Sandy Shaw auf die Bühne gebeten werden.
Mit dem Lied Puppet on a String. Music by Phil Coulter, words by Bill Martin, and it has been sung by Sandy Shaw.
I wonder if one day that you say that you care. If you say you love me madly, I'd gladly be there like a puppet on a string.
And then what we've got, this says news, isn't it, on this page? This is a news page.
Yeah, sort of gossip and news, isn't it, really? We got Sandy Shaw. Sandy, a hit, is likely to top Europe's charts.
Which is, she's not, I don't think she's very happy about, in a way. she never liked the song. Not that that's mentioned in the report. It sort of focuses on her, quote, apparently relaxed performance of the song, which I think is an indicator of, which funny, it kind of prefigures the relationship that Olivia Newton-John had in, was it 73 or 74 when she did Long Live Love? And the selection process was similar, I think, to what it was then. So back then, there was like a televised special where like one singer was chosen to do a number of songs, and then viewers would vote for their favourite, and their favourite is the one that would represent the UK in the Eurovision Song Contest.
Oh, okay.
That's how Cliff ended up entering with Congratulations.
Oh, okay.
And so Olivia Newton-John, you know, made no secret of the fact that she hated Long Live Love.
Oh.
And didn't, you know, there were other ones that she was far, you know, far keener to do.
Yeah.
And almost sort of, you know, inevitably the public said, actually, no, that's our favourite. Well, and I guess something similar happened with Sandy here.
Never give the public any votes, is what I say.
No, yes.
There's a series of, there's lots of articles on here. One thing, new singles set for release. So we've got new discs from Percy Sledge and the Tremolos, not together, including Little Games by the Yardbirds.
Little games are for little boys. I'm growing up and changing all my toys. Aeroplanes, motor cars, goldfish and old jam jars. I just don't play these games. No.
Lou Rawls, Dead End Street.
I was born in a city that they call the Windy City. They call it the Windy City because of the hawk. The hawk, the almighty hawk. Mr. Wind takes care of plenty of business around wintertime.
Neil Diamond, Girl, You'll Be a Woman Soon.
Girl, you'll be a woman soon. Love you so much, can't count all the ways I'd die for you, girl. And all they can say is, he's not your kind. They never get tired of putting me down, and I never know when I come around what I'm gonna find. Don't let them make up your mind. Don't you know, girl, you'll be a woman.
You know, all these songs in the middle of them, Out of Left Field by Percy Sledge, Otis Redding. One thing that did jump out at me, though, was further down, there are three songs about Tarzan.
Wow,
The Magician's Tarzan March, Marty Stanning and the Cheetahs with Tarzan's March, and you've got The Market's Tarzan's Dance. So, with Johnny Weissmuller on the cover of Sgt. Pepper, 1967 is the summer of... It is peak Tarzan.
Amazing. Wow. So, did any of them become hits?
No. I think it's because the TV series started around that time, didn't it? CBS one.
And it was only, about 18 years later that a Tarzan-based song actually got in the top 10 with Tarzan Boy by Baltimora.
Yes.
Which is, you'd be hard-pushed to find a better Tarzan song than that, I think. I see also that there's a new Bob Dylan single out on May the 5th, Leopard Skin Pillbox Hat. And what I would say, by and large, might be certainly my top three Bob Dylan songs of the 60s. Most likely You Go Your Way and I'll Go Mine. In my actual real life experience, the only Bob Dylan song you can DJ with and it won't clear the dance floor.
I wonder why, because it's Blonde on Blonde was 66. Yeah. We're now in April 67. It seems a long time after.
Maybe it's just taken people that long to get used to it. And but I don't know. But now that I know that you can get it on a 7-inch single, I'll seek one out. Because I love both of the songs. I mean, it's an amazing record, but I'm always very defensive and most likely you'll go Your Way and I'll Go Mine because it just seems to be the least popular song on that record. And I just think it's a complete banger.
Casino Royale is too much for one James Bond. Join the Casino Royale fun movement.
Mr. Bond? I'm Lieutenant Mathis of the Special Police.
Peter Sellers is James Bond.
These are my credentials.
They appear to be in order.
Ursula Andress is James Bond. David Niven is James Bond. Woody Allen is James Bond.
My doctor says I can't have bullets enter my body at any time. What if I said I was pregnant?
Joanna Pettit is James Bond.
Don't you ever be sad. You know me, when times are bad. When the day comes, and you are down. And all the trouble, and I'm... Hold on,
at the bottom, we've got the Hit the Road Stax tour, ended at Hammersmith Odeon last Saturday, and Sam of the Sam and Dave duo was pulled off the stage by fervent fans and was rescued and carried backstage by four attendants.
Wow.
And in the audience were Mick Jagger and Mariem Faithfull, Stevie Winwood and Lionel Bart. Negotiations are underway to repeat the Stax tour in 1968, and it never happened. But I think that says more about package tours.
Yeah.
Stacks
also
itself.
Maybe Otis Redding would have died died at the end of that year, didn't he?
December.
Yeah, so maybe that's possibly a factor as well.
Yeah.
There's a big story about that tour later on in this issue. And it is, I'm fascinated by that tour. I'm fascinated by the musicians' recollections of that tour. But let's park that for a second.
Yeah.
Because there's other work to do prior to then.
Save his life, call his wife in. Nothing to say, but what a day. How's your boy been? Nothing to do, it's up to you. I've got nothing to say, but it's okay.
On page page 5, there's a couple of photos at the top of the page. And it says Beatles session and LP.
Yeah, this is incredible, right? And the caption reads, "No, EMI haven't hired their studio to the Gypsies." So, obviously, you can sort of guess what the Beatles are wearing. I mean, yeah, I'm not sure. I don't know what the travelling people were want to wear in 1960, but I suspect it wasn't that. The Beatles are looking weirder in every photo taken of them these days. These shots were taken during the recording of their soon-to-be-released album titled Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. Do we think this might be the first mention of the title? Chris, do you know that if there was a previous mention of it?
In the Beatles book from April 67, Johnny Dean said about the photo, I mean, off the top of my head, I can't remember, but there were definitely photos from the session. Yeah, Johnny Dean, a.k.a. Sean Mahoney, he wrote, "There are other important changes in this month's Beatles book, which are going to continue from now on. The boys and Brian Epstein feel that almost all of the photographs in every issue from now on should be bang up to date and taken within a couple of weeks of publication. So as you can see from looking at the photographs on these pages, we're doing just that. They've certainly changed a great deal from the early Beatles back in 1962 and 63, or even for that matter, the Beatles of 64, 65, 66. Mm. We've told you that they've all grown moustaches of various shapes and sizes. And the photos in this issue, taken by Leslie Bryce, are the most recent you will see in any publication." Off the top of my head, I can't remember if it mentions the name of the album.
Yeah, yeah.
So
it's
got to
be a pretty early mention, right, if not the first.
Yeah.
Because in that kind of, you know, everything sort of happens so quickly at these times that, you know, a sort of, so what, April, May, June, so this is 2 months ahead of the release of the record. That in those days, that would constitute quite an early announcement for a title like that, you know.
Yes.
Given that you could write a song and actually have it in the shops 3 weeks later.
Yeah.
So that's incredible, yeah. Yeah.
They're great photos. I don't know if these are Leslie Bryce photos. Listeners will be able to tell me. But the Leslie Bryce is the official Beatles book photographer.
It's a shame these aren't in colour, given that, obviously, Record Mirror does have colour photography in it.
I close my eyes and soon I'm feeling sleepy. I sleep so easy. There's nothing on my mind. And life seems kind of, I want her, she wants me.
And then there's just beneath it, there's this story about the Mindbenders. You've been really busy, right?
Yeah.
Those schoolgirl days of telling tales and biting nails are gone. But in my mind, I know they
Mindbenders tell of their film and the first psychedelia, which is a strange way of phrasing it. But yeah, they almost refused their first film part in the forthcoming So We'd Love because they were so nervous. But Bob Lang from the group said, "We've just been along to see a preview of it and it's a very, very touching film with a great story," which I think we can obviously all agree with. So obviously, it's just one of the great, great singles of its era. Oh, and yeah. Many years later, the Trash Can Sinatras did a similarly wonderful version.
Oh, wow, yes. Yeah.
It's gorgeous.
Gosh, yeah. That is.
And so this conversation with Bill Harry is the author of this piece, goes, "The talk drifted over various subjects and Eric Stewart mentioned the appearance of psychedelic music in Britain. We saw psychedelic stuff a year before it was even heard of here and it was terrific, fantastic. This was in a huge auditorium in San Francisco. It was unbelievable, but it's never been done properly here. We asked the people what it was all about, and they said, 'We're trying to create an LSD dream.' The audience just sat down in the seats, watching us as if they were in a trance. There were moving, splashing lights all over us. So we started using feedback and working with them. We were surprised at the results. It almost sounds like they're kind of a bit unprepared, like they're almost like on stage and they need to be spontaneously be a bit psychedelic and just do some feedback or something. Yeah. But that's pretty early, really, to be feedback for a British act to be using feedback at this point. Seems quite early to me. Not like crazily early, but fairly early.
Well, even Floyd, I mean, you listen to some of their stuff, but I'm thinking of things like Walk With Me, Sydney, which is my favourite Pink Floyd song, which is will annoy lots of Pink Floyd fans.
That's okay.
But, it was all going around at the same time. Even things like you can hear the Beatles at Candlestick Park, and there at the beginning of their songs, I think it's Day Tripper or I Feel Fine, there's a definite meow, and they're messing around with the feedback, of course, deliberately. Yeah. So it's kind of something in the air, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, in America, it's more of a thing. The Velvet Underground, obviously, being a case in point. But, it's sort of interesting that they come back with that very specific kind of memory. And it's almost like psychedelia is so new to them that they can't really sort of put down a sort of boundary of what it is, so that they can recognize it. They say, we saw psychedelic stuff a year before it was even heard of, but they don't, it's a sort of, they know when they're in the presence of psychedelia, but they don't seem to be able to put more of a kind of handle on it than that.
No.
They're just sort of, it's like they enter a place where psychedelia is happening. And that's Eric Stewart, who sort of in the end, obviously, in not too long after that, was would form 10cc,
and also he's sharing a page with Paul, because obviously he'd worked with him on Tug of War and Pipes of Peace and
Press
to Play,
not harmoniously.
And there's also a quarter page ad for the Fab Denson disc offer, and it's 35 shillings worth of Top Pops for only 12 and 11. And you've got things like The In Crowd, Paul Revere and the Raiders, Johnny Cash, The Byrds, Bob Dylan, Simon & Garfunkel, Pete Seeger. And there's a big value voucher inside every box of Denson fashion shoes for men. Get yours now. And it was created exclusively for Denson by CBS Special Products, made to the high standards as regular CBS releases. Because CBS Special Products was specifically a manufacturer of TV advertised releases and third-party labels.
Oh, okay.
And mail order catalogues. If you look at the CBS Special Products online, there's a whole host of albums that came out. But this is quite it looks really good.
So you have to buy, so it's a cross-promotion. So there's a little illustration here of the different kind of Denson shoes that you can buy. There's Brogue, there's one in a style which is called Carnaby Street.
Yes.
Which is great, and then Classics and Sandor, which is a boot. This is a little bit like the promotional offer the Co-op department store were doing in 1983, when in the summer holidays, on school uniform. And so basically, if you bought either 20 or 25 pounds worth of school uniform from the department store, then you're allowed to, for free, you're allowed to have one top 10 record from their record department. And so I really had to sort of turn on the kind of, I had to really escalate my argument for sort of the fact that I really did need that shirt as well as that jumper in order to push it over 20 quid, knowing that I'd get a free, and then I'd have to say, oh, hello, it says there that I can have it. Oh, that's good, isn't it? And it worked. But actually, the top 10 in that particular week was a bit shit. And, usually in any given week in 1983, I would have found something that I really love. But the nearest I could find to a sort of a halfway decent song in the top 10 that week was Red Red Wine by UB40.
Okay.
Which was probably the first UB40 single I didn't like. So it felt somewhat unjust. So this is a similar thing, isn't it? You inside every, there's a big value voucher inside every box of Denson fashion shoes for men. Get yours now, and the voucher gets you allows you to buy this album inexpensively.
Similarly, I got there was the deal with Heineken in the early 80s when I was still a kid, and I managed to persuade my mum to buy me 4 cans of Heineken so I didn't drink them. Maybe I did, I don't know. But to get a Beatles cassette, which was basically, it was
Have you got the cassette?
I have, yes, I have. I haven't got the Heineken anymore.
Is it quite valuable?
I don't know. I think there's so many of them about.
Yeah, I guess so.
Wonderful.
So we turn to page 6, and we've got Peter Jones, editor of Record Mirror, who in 1963, after seeing them live at the Crawdaddy Club, was instrumental in recommending the Rolling Stones to Andrew Lou Goldham. And Beatles fans will be aware of his writing, as he used to write under the Beatles Book Monthly, under the pseudonym Billy Shepherd. Yeah, and he's talking about the Monkees, Davy Rumours, and Stage Act. More Davy Jones.
Yeah, he's everywhere. It's a lot. The kind of big hitters in this issue are the kind of the Stax Tour, which there's an advert for on this page as well. Quite a good advert. The first UK LP by Eddie Floyd, Knock on Wood.
Looks like a 1977 advert.
Does it? It does, doesn't it? Like a kind of one of those very inky New Musical Express adverts that you might see. Yeah, no, you're right. So this big sort of, I guess it's essentially a feature on Davy Jones, right?
Yeah. Well, they're talking about, because the Monkees have got their forthcoming gigs at Wembley Pool in July for the band that, you know, everyone said couldn't play. And I think there's a letter in here somewhere about that. But yeah, they're everywhere, and they're in all of the other magazines as well. I mean, obviously, we know they're big. But they're reported on relatively positively, considering that people at this point did know, you know, this heinous crime. They didn't play all of their instruments.
It's strange. You don't really think of the Monkees as being that sort of controversial a group, but there we are. Yeah, there's kind of great heavy play being made of, like, fans' disappointment that the only British shows are going to be at Wembley Pool, which is obviously later Wembley Arena. Yeah, well, you say you've heard bootlegs you've heard kind of audio.
I've heard live audio. I don't know if it is from the UK. And it's kind of punk. Because they're really thrashing away, and Mickey's obviously live on drums.
I mean, in a way, you don't want them to be that good, because you do. You know, you get that sort of, you know, you want it to be all a little bit like I'm Not Your Stepping Stone or something. You know, Mickey's kind of thrashing away. I mean, they were good. You know, like Mickey was great, and the, you know, you have Peter Tork and Mike Nesmith, who are just, you know, musicians anyway. So, in what sense are they not qualified to be a band, really?
Well, Davey mentions as well, doesn't he? You know, there are other bands. You'd be surprised if you knew what other bands were using session musicians.
I think I'm right in saying that the backing on your LP was not, in fact, played by your own.
The backing on the LP and the first two singles was studio musicians, as is with 95% of the groups nowadays. You know, I've been to sessions with top groups in Hollywood, man, that don't play on their own sessions.
Fair enough.
But nobody makes a big deal out of it. I know some groups that don't sing on their own sessions. They just go out on the road because they look good.
True.
And it was. Yeah. Big American bands.
Yeah, absolutely.
Were doing it. And
yeah, I mean, in what sense, really, in that sense, in what sense are they different to the Birds? You know, at least to, you know, Mr. Tambourine Man.
I was walking down the high street when I heard footsteps behind me. And there was a little old man, the scarlet and grey, chuckling away. Well, he trotted back to my house, and he sat beside the telly, with his tiny hands on his tummy, chuckling away, laughing all day. I ought to report you to the Gnome Office.
I guess this would be a recurring kind of theme in these podcasts, but the, you know, the sheer turnover of just records that we know about now that are just casually just dropped, you know. So new this week from Decca, we've got David Bowie, The Laughing Gnome.
Yeah.
And then Denny Lane with Say You Don't Mind. And then Mike Redway, who I'm not aware of, but it's a kind of, it's a Bond-themed track, right, with Have No Fear, Bond Is Here. I mean, there are a lot of kind of...
So would that be a Casino Royale song from that? I don't know. We need... No,
there's a lot
John
of
it
around. There's also, what is it, Socket to Them JB, which I thought was about James Brown, but it is apparently James Bond.
Wow.
And then a couple of pages on, David Bowie also gets a mention in Tony Hall's column, which is called My Scene.
Mm-hmm.
And he writes, "Dig David Bowie." I think this is a different Tony Hall to the one who went on to become Director General of the BBC. Dig David Bowie, singer-songwriter, arranger, producer, social commentator, general all-round talent, very Tony Newley-ish. His first LP is a gas. And now that's interesting because his first LP isn't going to be out. He's clearly finished. It's doing the rounds in some form.
Yeah.
But it's not going to be out until, sadly for him, the same week that Sgt. Pepper comes out. And yes. So, which is, I don't know if that's enough to have done for him. I don't know. Do you think Bowie's first album could have been more successful had it not come out in the week of Sgt. Pepper?
No.
No, I don't think so either. I think it's...
There's no obvious singles.
There's some great things, like Made of Bond Street is... Yeah. You know, I love to bits. And Dear Mr. Gravedigger.
That's not a single, is it?
Not really a single, but what's sort of interesting about it is that there are things that he did later, but the ratio is sort of wrong. So, you know, what he's trying to do is sort of sitting at the intersection of performance art and sort of theatre and pop. And which, you know, really is Ziggy, that's what Ziggy Stardust is, right?
Yeah.
He's just not getting it's not the right recipe for the right moment, really. So, you know, he'll sort of, well, obviously we sort of know that he'll get there.
Excuse me. Please, Mr. Gravedigger, don't feel ashamed as you dig little holes for the dead and the maimed. Please, Mr. Gravedigger, I couldn't care if you found a golden bucket full of some girl's hair and you put it in your bucket.
But also, yeah. I guess a lot of, because reading through a lot of these publications, pretty well, every time he's mentioned at this time, it's all Anthony Newley. Mm-hmm. And I guess Anthony Newley was not old news, but he'd had his sort of cool peak.
Yeah.
And it's like, why would you copy him, even though that you can hear it's him, yeah. But it's definitely Anthony Newley, and there's too much, like, Love You Till Tuesday, there's one particular line in there that just makes me cringe.
Who's that hiding in the apple tree, clinging to a branch? Don't be afraid, it's only me, hoping for a little romance. If you lie beneath my shade.
He's just trying new things all the time, isn't he? He's just trying to sort of like get traction, and it hasn't happened, and we don't know when it's going to happen. You know, obviously he's relentless. I mean, you know, his tenacity is sort of, is incredible, really. Tony's also convinced that Denny Lane is due to have a monster hit with Say You Don't Mind. He said this really is a work of love.
It's a beautiful song.
I realise that I've been some kind of fool. What'd I do, what I did, stupid fish, I drank the pool. I've been doing some dying, now I'm doing some trying. They'll say you don't mind, let me off this night.
Absolutely, yeah.
Because Tony Hall, he'd previously been a record exec at Decca and had hosted a sponsored show on Radio Luxembourg. And he co-hosted Oh Boy.
Oh.
But now he'd quit Decca and he'd formed one of the UK's first independent promotion companies, Tony Hall Enterprises. And he went on to promote artists like Hendrix, Joe Cocker, okay. Black Sabbath. But have you seen that letter from Apple turning down David Bowie?
No.
Yeah, and it's on show at the Bowie Centre at the V&E East storehouse. And it's a letter to Kenneth Pitt Management from 15th of July 1968 that reads, "Dear Sir, as we have told you on the phone, Apple Records is not interested in signing David Bowie. The reason is that we don't feel he is what we're looking for at the moment. Thank you for your time. Yours sincerely, Peter Asher, Head of A&R for Apple Records."
Oh, my God. Wow.
But again, if they're turning him down, you can see why the public turned him down at this time.
Yeah.
I do love this era of Bowie.
I play that record, you know, quite a lot, you know. And I will always sort of turn up for it. Do you know what I mean? I just think it's just a hugely charming record. And it also, like, reminds you that this is a period where the kind of lines between the lines of demarcation between pop and rock, like the distinction between pop and rock in itself is quite a new and novel distinction. And, you know, these are all sort of being formed before our eyes. And, you know, light entertainment, you know, we'd be sort of quite edgy, emerging rock stars are really kind of going to the same after hours drinking holes as, you know, people like, you know, Jimmy Tarbuck or Bruce Forsyth or whoever, they're all at the Bag of Nails, just sort of hanging out with each other, basically.
Yeah.
So it's not, they've just chosen their little branches of light entertainment or heavy entertainment, whatever you want, whatever it is they've chosen. Mm. But they're all doing their thing. But I don't think they see themselves as adversarial to each other.
Mm. This era, Bowie, those songs I love on these Live at the BBC compilation. They've just got a bit more punch to them.
Oh, so what, In the Heat of the Morning?
Yeah.
Stuff like that.
Oh, that's a great
brilliant
song.
Yeah. But also In the Heat of the Morning, he's actually like, he kind of basically pilfers that melody to write Ziggy Stardust later on. It's the same, very similar top line.
Yes.
To the
yeah. Oh, wow. I don't know, is that?
I know. Hiding in Plain Sight.
In the heat of the morning.
That's the end of part one. However, you can listen to the whole interview at patreon.com/eggpod. Join us next week for part two, where there's controversy surrounding the Hit the Road Stax tour and find out who made the charts, the new singles, new albums, and much more. To support this podcast and to access bonus content, please subscribe to patreon.com/eggpod. And again, this issue of Record Mirror is online at iamtheeggpod.com, where you'll also find an exclusive playlist related to this particular episode. But that's it for now. See you next time. Bye.